Adam, welcome into the back room.
Thank you for having me, Annie. This is going to be a great conversation.
It sure is. And I just want to say before we start, get your fucking hand out of my face, okay?
I have people that come up to me on the street sometime and they just say that, then walk away. And I'm like, that's an interesting
You
interaction.
should get like t-shirts made.
No, I can't milk it that much at some point. At some point, it's like if I'm getting t-shirts made, it's too much. But
I
also, I
do
do
have to
like.
applaud you because, and I do want to talk about this in a little while, but I do have to applaud you because, like, you're literally, I think, the only person that really sent Scott Jennings into an emotional tailspin, which I don't think is easy to do because he's a pretty composed dude, and does what he does well. I disagree with 105% of what he says, but you got under his skin. But you've built a large audience by aggressively fact-checking Republican politicians and conservative media figures like Scott Jennings in real time. You're really smart. You come armed with receipts. I think you're just 23 years old, right? You can articulate your positions better than most people twice your age. But before we get into all of that good stuff, I want to go back in time a little bit. I think a lot of people would love to know your background. What were you like as a single-digit kid in early teens? And were your parents very political? And when did you first get interested in politics?
It's a great question. Thank you for having me again. So, I grew up in Indiana, a red state, and I now live in Chicago. And growing up in Indiana, there were a bunch of formative experiences that allowed me to build what I've built today. The YouTube channel that I currently run has 2 million followers, but I made that channel when I was 9 years old, in the single digits. And when I was nine, I used to make these Minecraft or like Call of Duty videos. You're familiar with Minecraft, of course, right?
Sure.
Of course. So I would make these videos after school where I play Minecraft and then I edit it up. And I would edit over and over and over. And I built a passion for editing. I also remember in fifth grade, I got kicked out of my class for debating my teacher on gay marriage at the time. It was around
As all
FFL.
fifth graders do.
Yeah, as all fifth graders. Well, like, I think honestly, I was being a little bit of a disruptive shit. I mean, it's like a fifth grade. I am trying to debate my teacher and he kicks me out. Morally, I was in the right place. And then I get into middle school and high school and I stopped making the Minecraft videos because I wanted to, get girls and not be the Minecraft guy who's always playing video games. But in doing so, I
Are
was.
you suggesting those nerds are not very popular with girls?
Well, they can be, but I just had to tone it down. I couldn't be
Depends on the
the.
girl, right?
Yeah, depends on. That's a good point. I mean, maybe I do want a girl that likes a Minecraft nerd. That's very true. But in high school, I kind of toned it down. I wasn't the YouTube guy anymore. I didn't want to be that. And when I graduated high school, I hated the structure of high school. I was in honors classes. I was smart, but I hated the structure. It felt very rigid. It felt like there was no room for creativity. So I go to college and I take this film class, and this film class allowed me to have more creativity, more, dynamic, putting myself out there in a more dynamic way. So I then realized I can combine all of these skills that I built over the course of the past decade in editing videos, producing videos, talking politics with people in Indiana. And I started to research Trump rallies nearby. I was living in Indiana, and there was one in Iowa because it was the Iowa caucuses. So I drove like 7 hours alone. This at 20 years old, this was the longest I'd driven alone, 7 hours away. Emailed 30 to 40 different cameramen, just trying to find one. And one dude responded and said, "This is my only free weekend. Maybe let's try it." 3 years later, he's my main camera guy. He's actually flying in tonight because we're doing a team meeting this weekend. And we went to the Trump rally. You can see it. It's the first ever public video on my channel. It says, debating Trump supporters. And it's very interesting because you can see me, very green, very fresh, debating these people, but also in a very good faith way. I was kind of sick at the time of people going to Trump rallies with the sole goal of making people look as dumb as possible. How dumb can I make these people look? I bet I can run circles around these people. Yeah, I bet you can. But the thing is, there's another style that is more affable that gets people to kind of hear you out. So then I started building that flow, going to the Iowa caucuses. I was covering Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, all these different campaigns, and I would go talk to their supporters. I actually would go follow Vivek around and ask him questions about Russia and Ukraine because he just had the worst takes. And I'd be like, "How can this be possible if this?" And he'd
That's a
get like,
shocker.
"Yeah, he yeah, it's a shocker." He'd get really annoyed because I would just kind of pester him with questions, right? Through all of that, I built up this apparatus around me and this team around me. Worked with Midas Touch, now building on CNN. I don't work with him, but I'm
And
just building a flow there.
was your family, is your family political?
Yeah, definitely. My uncle, who's like, he's my family's young. My mom had me at 15 years old,
Wow.
and she got her PhD while she was raising me. And all of these experiences for me.
What? There's a story there. You have to like elaborate just a little bit, like how that all.
She had me at 15. My dad was 16, and they were very, very young. And then that didn't stop my mom from then going on to getting her bachelor's,
and then
master's, and then PhD. She got at age 32 or 33. Now she's like 39. But she has a PhD in industrial organizational psychology, which is how to build leaders and how to build teams around people, which is kind of perfect for what I'm trying to do, because whenever I need to give someone feedback or build my team, she helps me a lot. Not in a formal way. She's not a formal part of my business, but informally I call her at night and I'm like, hey, I need this, this, this. Can you help me with this? And it's very helpful. So to answer your question, though, yes, my family is political. Also, the formative experiences around me were important. My dad is Muslim. My grandpa is from Syria on my dad's side. And I used to go to Friday prayer because they really wanted me to be Muslim traditionally, but I didn't buy it. But I would go to the Friday prayer and I'd be around diversity and I would understand that, okay, diversity is good. And then my uncle, when I was like, 12, he's like 35 now. I was 12, he was like 24 maybe. He kind of taught me about atheism. I think he would always watch Bill Maher or like all these like, libs at the time, which I still really like. And that kind of, introduced me to this sphere.
Yeah. Well, that's an incredible story. And I think there's so much in what you just said that I would probably think that 99% of the people who like you and follow you don't know about you.
Yeah.
And it's what a crazy, terrific story. But it also, it makes sense to me because I look at you and I see like what you've accomplished at such a young age and look who your role models were.
First of all, I really appreciate that. Thank you. And yeah, honestly, it's all about having the right team around you. It's all about having the right people around you to guide you. And something that I do is I try to learn from people, good or bad. And this might surprise you, but I've learned from Scott Jennings. I've learned things from Donald Trump. This isn't a praise of them at all. But
all right, wait, time out. Give me one thing you've learned from Jennings, one thing you've learned from Trump.
Of course, yeah. When I first went on to CNN, I at first was going up against Kevin O'Leary. Then I did well.
Another tremendous political mind, but yes, go ahead.
Tremendous. So sharp. So sharp. And then they invited me back, and eventually I went up against Jennings. I'm green on TV. It's like I've never really been on TV, so I learned from his body language. He would sit there confidently, he'd fold his hands, and he would be very steady, very stoic, rather unshakable until, the shakable moment, but
until you shake him.
Yeah, until you shake him. Yeah,
you shake him up, and what comes out is, get your fucking hand out of my face.
Exactly. But I think it would be arrogant of me as a 23-year-old to think I can't learn anything from this experienced professional on TV. I've also learned what not to do. Never back yourself in a corner by taking a very unpopular position. So he taught me that as well. But no. I swear, when I would sit down, I would kind of learn from his body language, confidently looking into the camera, confidently smug. And I would kind of just, analyze that and be like, okay. So there is something to be said about sitting in a power position. And then I guess, I've learned a lot from Trump on what not to do and how not to be a narcissistic, arrogant asshole. But he's also just kind of taught me that a lot of transactions in business are negotiations. I guess negotiation pops up everywhere when you start to think about it. Just the push and pull of trying to get to a middle ground. And as much as I hate his style of presidency, there's something to be said about just asking for more, and then you end up getting somewhere in between. He didn't come up with that, but his ability – when he does these crazy asks, and to us is absolutely lunacy, it just made me realize there's a framework where, when I'm negotiating my rent, you weigh under, over ask, and just try to
right. Although in the case of Iran, his strategy seems to be ask for nothing and get even less.
Yeah, it seems to be
– not a great negotiation.
It seems to be – he's not a great – no. None of this is to, praise his negotiation skills, especially on the national stage. International stage, it's an absolute mess, and it doesn't work. But, again, there's something to be at least learned from these things.
Sure. Look, I say it all the time. He's an evil genius. Evil genius. I don't think he's stupid because I think to become president twice – only 45 other humans – other men have been elected to that office in our 250-year history. So you had to do something right. Whatever it is, however nefarious or corrupt, you had to identify what you needed to do to achieve this very rare position.
He's really stupid. You're right. He's really stupid on policy. I don't think he knows anything about the actual policy. You can ask him about Iran, Karg Island, the JCPOA.
Right, or history.
He doesn't know anything about that. He doesn't know anything about history. he does, in I think even liberals in the audience that will think this is, oh, controversial, it's they'll understand what I'm saying here. He does have an intuition on how to sell himself to the general public. And I've seen somebody who was on a show with him one time says that he can kind of walk into a room and sense what the people around him need to hear at that moment. And even though he's an absolute idiot on policy, he clearly in these rooms is doing something that is, you know, comforting people. Like, he's clearly courting these Republicans either through threats, through power, or I've heard that behind the scenes, you know, he's a little bit different. He's not just going effing crazy behind the scenes. Sometimes he's actually more methodical. So, yeah, idiot on policy, maybe understand, he understood how to play the political game. He did take over the entire Republican Party, but now he doesn't know. I mean, the PR is so bad. The guy the other day is like, I love inflation. I love inflation. He's like, I'm not even.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't love inflation? Don't we all love inflation, of course?
I personally try to spend as much money as humanly possible on everything I spend.
Yeah, I'm actually basing my next vote election. Who can bring more inflation next election? That's what I want them to ask on the debate stage.
But, you know, even in some sick, twisted way, he's all about, like, numbers and the bigness of them. So, like you're saying about his ignorance with policy, like, 5% would be better than 4%. But we're talking about inflation, not, like, you know, GDP growth.
GDP growth,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, he's kind of conflating these things.
The thing about Scott Jennings is that he does always seem measured and composed, but you always know when he's not, because, like, he'll do that smirk thing. Like, if he's listening to somebody, if he's listening to you or whatever, he'll do this. Right? He makes that face, and then you know he's, like, kind of bubbling up on the inside. So
he's like
you become
confused. He's always confused.
Exactly. You become particularly well-known for your exchanges with him. Why do you think those clips, those exchanges resonate so much with so many people on the left and also piss off many on the right?
I mean, for the obvious reasons, the age difference, the experience disparity, the fact that I'm still building, you know, I'm early career and he's been doing this for a while. But I think if you want to get down to the core of it, it's that we've lost this assertive form of liberalism or this assertive form of debate where we're actually pushing our ideas. You know what it really is? It's that for the past decade, Republicans have been playing by one set of rules where they can condescend people on TV. They can be smug to people. He'll smirk, cross his arms, take a sip, and then he'll cut off any female on the panel and make a really bad point where he misrepresents them. He's not bound by any of these rules on television. He's not bound by the reality of timelines. He's not bound by the reality of facts. So then I go on there and I say, I'm not going to handcuff myself to these rules if he's not playing by the rules either. I don't even think I'm overly aggressive, but I do think I can assert myself in a way that is probably unbecoming to a Republican. I thought about it a lot, actually, my style on these shows, and I'm like, am I way too aggressive? Am I? But I've come to the conclusion when people come up to me in public, they say, keep doing it exactly how you are. So being assertive and actually pinning them down is so important. I am so sick of this media environment where Republicans muddy the waters by lying and misconstruing a point. And then they muddy the waters and then the host will just move on. The host will be like, well, okay, I mean, that's a point that you make. Okay, well, how about this other thing? And then we move on. Hell no. No moving on. So one of my goals with these shows is to pin them down and ask the same question. I'm going to ask the same question again if you don't answer. Okay, I'm going to ask the same question again if you're not going to answer my question. It's very important that we pin these people down because they're not playing the game. They're not playing by any rules.
Yeah, well, and you could say the same thing about Trump too. And that's why it's frustrating to watch the White House press corps be so neutered. Like, he'll say a lie and then they go on to the next question. There's no challenge. There's no pushback. They're all terrified. There's no Jim Acosta. There's no Brian Karam. There's no Sam Donaldson. Nobody's pushing back. And on these shows, I mean, I love Abby Phillips. I think she's a terrific journalist.
She's great.
You know, her show opens with her saying something like, people can't talk to each other about politics anymore, but they do here. But then the program is often a brutal, contentious slugfest filled with lies. Is this a healthy environment?
I think that they're only a function of the political environment that we're in. I think that sometimes when people point to Jubilee as a format or other debate shows and say, these are the reason that things are getting worse, I think it's almost like a chicken or the egg thing, which came first.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
right.
I mean, our politics right now is at a point where it's, you know, brutal, based on virality, and it's an attention economy. You want to grab attention. But that's not because of, you know, the format of CNN or of Jubilee. It's because of the way that, number one, Donald Trump has rewired politics to make it very attention-based. Number two, the algorithms have rewired politics to make it very attention-based. And then it incentivizes this type of stuff. So the question is, what's the battlefield that we're playing on right now? And I think the battlefield that we're playing on is getting attention and using that attention to drive a narrative. Sometimes people say, like, oh, I wish you wouldn't do that. I wish you wouldn't go on this platform. Somebody told me one time, you shouldn't talk to Jubilee or work with Jubilee because you're just giving them a platform. And I'm like, no. Like, they're giving me a platform to debate and get my ideas across and grab attention.
Exactly.
Even if
exactly.
The format is suboptimal. I mean, yeah, in an ideal world, the CNN panels are like Northwestern University debate where we're all sitting there and we all have rules that we're bound by. But we're not in that ideal world. We're in a world where the president of the United States is throwing jabs in order to gain attention online, and we have to gain attention reciprocally. Is that a word?
Yeah. And none of them are tethered to the truth or reality, which makes the job of someone like yourself that much more difficult. But that's why it is so refreshing and so critically important, I think, when someone like you comes along and has the kind of clarity and focus that you do, which so many other people don't. And that includes so many people. I won't name names, but there are people that are on Abby's show and others that have been in Democratic circles for years. There still seems to be this need or desire by Democrats. And there have been a couple of like famous cases where, like, if Trump is able to speak for 5 minutes without drooling, they're like, he was presidential tonight.
Yeah.
And I watch that and I go, are you fucking kidding me? Like, has the bar been lowered so much for this guy that if he doesn't mock a disabled person, then he's presidential? You never do that. You will never throw these gratuitous hyperbolic props at him or Republicans. You stay focused on the issue. You come at it with receipts and truth and facts. And oftentimes they just move on to the next thing, as you said. But have you ever experienced with either Jennings or anyone else where they've changed their position or conceded a point after one of your fact checks?
No, the incentives don't really play out that way. But there are moments where I've asked such a surgical question that he just can't answer. Like we were talking about a few months ago, this was like five, six months ago probably now. We were talking about some case and we were talking about extremism in politics. And I immediately was like, can you condemn Paul Ingrassia, who Donald Trump appointed to the GSA and who said, I have a Nazi streak. You can look this up. This guy said, I have a Nazi streak.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott Jennings said, I don't know if I'm familiar with that matter. And I was like, okay, I'll tell you what happened. This happened. And if you believe me, can you condemn that? He's like, well, I can't condemn somebody I don't know. I was like, you don't have to know the guy. And he was like, I don't really know what you're talking about. Like, he just slithers out of it. That's what you have to do. Gone are the days of Democrats constantly being on the back foot. As you were saying, some of the more legacy people, not just on networks that I go on, but other networks that are like liberals, that are legacy liberals, they'll give ground in spaces or they get tricked into being on their back foot, and I hate that. I see it all the time. And Scott Jennings is very good at putting Democrats on their back foot over and over and over. It could be the worst topic ever for them. It could be Trump's crypto corruption. And you know what Jennings will do? He'll go, huh, so you're saying to me you're not concerned about Hunter Biden doing this? Can you explain to the audience why Hunter Biden did this? And then the Democrat is like, well, okay, in the Hunter Biden case, and they start explaining it. It's like, dog,
right.
you're on your back foot now. He let you get on your back foot. So this is my strategy with Graham Plattner in particular. I'm never going to stake my reputation on Graham Plattner. I'm not going to run defense for his past mistakes. He doesn't even run defense for his past mistakes. He's somebody that I was uncertain about and that I now think needs to win this main Senate seat, right? But I'm never going to stake my reputation on him. However, when I'm on these panels and they're asking me about Graham Plattner, the strategy is to now just go on offense right away.
Yes.
So it's like, you just asked me about Graham Plattner because you're concerned about his tattoo. I went through your Twitter and not once did you condemn Nick Fuentes and Donald Trump having dinner. Not once in your entire career have you mentioned Paul Ingrassia at the GSA. And then they're going to be like, wait a minute. And then you have them on their back foot is the ideal reality. It doesn't always work out that way.
No, but that's being like immovable. You can't shake you. You can't be distracted by some bullshit that they throw your way. And that is the key. I was going to ask you, like, what is the key? And that is the key. It's like you just have to stay focused. And so many of these folks that go on these shows, they get sucked into it, like you say, and they allow themselves to have a narrative that's controlled not by them anymore, but by the other person that they're debating.
Playing on their turf then. I mean, there's a quote from The Art of War about this where Sun Tzu's like, the ultimate art of war is – subduing the enemy without fighting on their field. That's what you have to do.
Yeah. Look, when I post about Graham Platner in particular, because he's been in the news a lot for the obvious reasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I go, well, okay, let me think about this. So you guys who voted for three times and still support, a 34 count convicted felon, adjudicated sexual abuser, accused by 20 plus women of sexual assault, accused of raping a 13-year-old girl. That's okay, but Platner's a bad guy? Can we just start with the guy that's in the White House? Like, keep it on that, because that not only is reality and fact, but it also puts them on the defensive and shows the hypocrisy of these positions. But the media is complicit in that.
Yeah.
The media, I've not seen one person in the legacy media be like, wow, how could they be criticizing Platner for whatever warts he has when they are supporting blah, blah, blah. I don't know whether it's fear or whatever, but they have to maintain that, you know, whatever they
balance,
think is, you know, integrity or whatever, you know.
Well, it's like a faux pseudo balance. They think they're providing a balanced perspective, but in doing so, you're already skewing it towards the crazy people. If we're having a debate about if the election in California was rigged or not rigged, we're already on losing turf. We shouldn't be having,
yes.
Like, we can have this conversation, we can have this debate, but we're starting off with a flawed axiom, a flawed premise. And I think that it's very, very important to be reframing these things. Like with Graham Platner, all these cable outlets and a lot of people on the right are treating this election like it's a referendum on Graham Platner's character. It's Graham Platner versus Susan Collins. I've never seen news shows taking this frame where it's like, okay, well, let's look at who he's running against. You know, no, they're just like talking about his warts, as you said. I also will never, ever let a Republican lecture me about standards of candidates in politics for the reasons that you listed.
Right.
They're the ones that plunged us in. They plunged us into this like post-cancellation, post-purity political sphere. They're the ones who plunged us into this with Donald Trump, with Ken Paxton, with all of these people.
Yes, Ken Paxton. How are we not talking about Ken Paxton every time we talk about Graham Platner? Like,
how are Democrats on their back foot about Graham Platner without bringing up – exactly, Ken Paxton. Put them on their back foot. How? This guy is – cheated on his wife and got divorced by his wife. His staffers turned him in for bribery. He was impeached by his own party, but Graham Platner sexted some people consensually, which, like, I'm not going to like run defense for things that he did. Like, did he cheat on his wife? I don't know. I think she said that they worked through it. The allegations that were against him, I find to be pretty despicable. I mean, I believe women. The statistics show that women actually underreport abuse, mm-hmm. rather than like overreport.
Of course. Most powerful man in the world, yeah. You know, calls it a hoax.
But like all of this stuff doesn't take away from the fact that Susan Collins is the definition of a swamp creature who promised to run for 2 terms and is running for a 6th term, basically.
I'm writing it down, swamp creature. Even with everything we've seen in the last 11 years, there's a core percentage of the Democratic the public Democrat and the media Democrats, the journalists, that want to be accepted and liked by the Republicans and by Trump. And they see their own legitimacy in that. They think, like, I'm better than this. I mean, I was listening to somebody, I forget who it was. She was a fairly big wig in the Democratic Party, and she withdrew her endorsement of Graham Platner. And she said, the reason I did that, excuse me, is because we need to show that we are better than they are. And I'm like, no, we don't. Okay. We need the fucking Senate. That's what we need to do. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I don't agree. Like you said, I don't agree with things that Platner may or may not have, you know, allegedly done in his life or whatever. But I also think that our democracy is hanging on by thread. I see incredible levels of corruption in the White House. I see people getting shot in the face and in the back in Minneapolis. Like, there's some bad, you know what? I'll deal with Graham Platner once he's in the Senate and we can legislate some of this shit to make America a better place. How about that?
Yeah, you're right. In an ideal world, there would be standards for leaders in our country, anyone who's in a position of power in our country, who are ideally the standards are so high that somebody like Donald Trump doesn't meet them, that one of his scandals disqualifies him. Maybe those standards are so high that someone like Graham Platner doesn't meet them as well or doesn't qualify, but we're not living in this idealistic reality. We're rather far from that. We're living right now in a tit-for-tat political battle with the Republican Party, who's trying to rig the midterms by gerrymandering and surgically dissecting black communities, so much so that Democrats now have to overcome a 5-point deficit in the midterms. We have to gain, we have to win by 5 points just to even out the playing field. Republicans have created an environment in the House where they are already R plus five due to their rigging. We live in the actual political reality where it's a tit for tat game where the Republican Party is taking us down to new lows, new lows, new lows, and we can't just be staying in the same spot. At some point, this is how tit for tat works. You have to keep matching. You have to keep going down and matching their energy. I'm not a fan of gerrymandering. It's kind of like the same thing with Graham Platner. But I am a fan of Democrats reciprocally using gerrymandering in order to stop the rigging of our elections. Like he's actually trying to rig the midterms. I'm not just saying that. It's genuinely what he's trying to do, which you of course know. And there needs to be this type of tit for tat. That actually, it does piss me off when Democrats are like, we're better than this. We shouldn't be gerrymandering in these states. Yeah, in an ideal reality, we're all better than this, but we're not in that ideal reality.
No, we're not even in the same, you know, hemisphere. Like, that's the thing. It's crazy. And, like, you'd say, like, how could they still be thinking this? And that's why I think voices like yours are so important. My last question is this. You've built your audience largely through digital platforms and younger voters. How engaged is Gen Z right now? We're 6 months out from the midterms. Are they motivated? Are they excited? Are they going to show up on November 3rd in numbers that we need them to?
It's hard. Younger generations tend to not turn out as much as older generations. This is just a fact of politics that's always been there. Older generations who have a house and are planted in a community and are building a life, or have built a life rather, have more incentive to go and participate in their community. I think young people have every incentive to as well, but the reality is young people are sometimes moving around, going to college, not really thinking about voting in that manner. But we are trying to spread awareness for young people to vote in the midterms and turn out en masse. Gen Z is a uniquely activated generation due to the fact that we've got social media, we've got this decentralized way of getting news at any time right in our hand, and we can get news about certain elections. So Gen Zers will turn out, I think, at higher rates than prior young generations when they were our age. I don't know if Gen Z is going to have like a midterm blowout where we all show up and change the results of the midterms. I mean, we're going to try that. I'm going to try to do that. But the brutal reality is that young people need to be motivated in order to vote. And there's a lot of apathy right now. There's a lot of apathy because young voters got burned the last time they voted. Donald Trump always claims he won Gen Z. He didn't actually win Gen Z by a majority, but he did get a way higher vote share than any of us expected. And that's because during a lot of our most formative years, maybe not, I was paying attention to politics. So just for a lot of Gen Zers' most formative years, Donald Trump was in the Oval Office, but people weren't fully paying attention to it. I mean, COVID sucked. His response sucked. But I was in 10th, 11th grade. I was doing these debates with my friends, but most people weren't paying attention. So Trump had the opportunity to then lie and kind of rebrand himself as the anti-establishment, anti-status quo person, even though he created the status quo and had 4 years before. So a lot of young people kind of fell for this idea that Donald Trump was going to rewire things for them and help unrig the system for them. But as John Ossoff says, he only rigged it for himself even more. And for a lot of young voters, the idea of getting a house feels farther away. A lot of my friends are graduating college and they can't find a job for a year. For a lot of young people, there's crippling student debt or medical debt. And the idea of even being like capital positive, not having negative capital, seems very far away for many, many young people. So I think that they can be motivated. Zohran Mamdani's campaign in New York is a great example of that. But they need to be motivated by, you know, someone that's unique, someone that speaks to their issues. People can be reductive and say, oh, a bunch of socialist teenagers or a bunch of socialist kids voted for Zohran. No. They're just not invested in a system that they don't feel has been tailored to them or has worked for them thus far. And I know that's a very young Gen Z thing to say, because we still have time to build this capital, to build this. But we are in a unique spot right now due to the way algorithms work, due to the antisocial behavior that's climbing in my generation, and due to the job market that kind of creates a confluence of factors that's really rough. We can do a whole podcast about the antisocial behavior of Gen Z off the back of COVID and algorithms. You know, like over 50% of young guys my age have never approached a woman in person and asked her out, which is crazy. And there's a lot of downstream effects for stuff like that, but that's for another conversation.
That certainly is. I'd love to have that conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope that whoever's going to run for president in 28 on the Democratic side listens to the stuff you just said and watches how Mamdani won in New York, the way he did, and how he energized young people. Because I don't think somebody can win without that. Adam, great conversation. I do hope you come back and chat with us again.
Really enjoyed that, Andy. Hit me up whenever.
All righty, take care.